tens of thousands of people were shot and killed on January 8th and January 9th. They were hunted in the hospitals and they were finished off in hospital beds. Imagine the outrage and anger and fury that people are suppressing because they know that if they pour that out in the streets, they're gonna get killed. And it's not gonna go anywhere. But when people think that the killing machine is now weakened and destroyed, they will gain that courage and motivation back to come out to the street and take over the government. The Islamic Republic has been campaigning for a war against Israel and America for decades. I lived there, I went to school there. Remember that as a kid, we were going to my aunt's house in the highway, there was this big sign saying like 250 days until Israel is destroyed.
Good evening, Asher.
Hey, Bev, how are you doing?
I'm good. We are recording in like this like limbo time where we don't know, is there going to be some sort of deal or even a negotiation between the U.S. and Iran?
Right, there's these reports of negotiations that are supposed to take place between Vice President Vance, Stephen Witkoff, and Iranian leaders, whoever they may be, in Pakistan. But I think people are already asking, is President Trump, is this just a pause for tactical reasons or to show a good faith intent to have negotiations, or is there real substance here? What do you think?
Well, first of all, it's not even a full-on pause, right? It's a pause on attacking energy facilities, which last week when Israel attacked the gas field that's shared between the Qataris and Iran, Trump denied that the U.S. knew about it, which is implausible, but that's what he said. And then basically made it sound already like he wasn't really going to bomb energy facilities or energy, you know, gas fields, things like that, oil facilities. So it's sort of like, what is he actually pausing if he's saying he wasn't going to do that? But okay, he announced this five-day pause and he said, he keeps saying he thinks that the Iranians really want to reach a deal. So like, he has a history of playing mind games with Iran, but the thing that makes me really worried is that Netanyahu sent former Minister Dermer, who's like Netanyahu's closest advisor, not because there's anything wrong with Dermer. Dermer is a very smart person. And I, you know, whatever, I don't have doubts that he has Israel's, you know, that he has the best intentions. It's just that if Netanyahu is sending Dermer, then Netanyahu is taking this seriously, at least the whole negotiations thing.
My sense is that on the one hand, it seems like Trump does want to give at least a chance for negotiations, at least to show that he is opening the door. At the same time, we have more and more American troops moving into place. We have an opportunity to replenish supplies, replenish interceptors, to perhaps stabilize the energy markets, to assist some of the regional countries with enhancing their air defenses even more. Now, if we are heading towards an agreement, I think there's, you know, certain principles that are really critical for any kind of good deal. I think we have to have a deal where all the enriched uranium is taken out of Iran and Iran agrees to zero enrichment, no enrichment, not 60%, not 30%, no enrichment going forward. We have to have real limits, obviously, on their ballistic missile program, the type, the range, and those have to be set in stone.
I want to interject on the ballistic missiles issue because Israel and the U.S. have done, and it's mostly Israel in this specific task, has done a really good job at degrading the ballistic missile threat. They've destroyed a lot of launchers, a lot of missiles, and Iran no longer has the capacity to produce or manufacture more missiles, at least during wartime. But what we saw in the last war is that the minute the war ended, they started hyper-producing missiles. And so even now, when I spoke to, you know, the IDF spokesperson's office about this, they said, like, all we can say is that they can't produce missiles now. We can't promise what they'll do later. I think it's just important to note because Israel and the U.S. keep saying, like, oh, you know, we've done such a great job with the ballistic missiles. But actually, as long as this regime stands, you have to have some sort of agreement that they're not going to do it all over again.
Absolutely. And then the same also holds true for the nuclear program. In fact, they're going to be much more motivated to rush towards a nuclear capability to rebuild their ballistic missile program after these current operations. Mojtaba, in fact, was critical of his father and supported the idea of advancing the Iranian nuclear program and getting to that breakout capacity. We don't know if, you know, to what degree he's involved in any decision making, but other members of the IRGC who seem to be calling the shots have also been supportive of rushing towards a breakout ability. Actually, I think the most important thing is that the outcome of this agreement, which could be a ceasefire and opening up the Hormuz, and there's been talk about a U.S.-Iran jointly managing the strait. But what's, I think, most critical is that the United States keeps the economic sanctions and Iran's diplomatic and political isolation. Because as long as those sanctions are in place, then the damage that's been caused to the regime, to the besieged, to the IRGC, to the mechanisms of repression, plus the economic challenges, create the conditions for eventually the Iranian people rising up and retaking their country.
By the way, the U.S., I mean, lifted some of the sanctions on Iranian oil in an attempt to stabilize the market, or, I don't know, to sort of make it more likely that Iran will come to the negotiating table. But there's been a lot of criticism of that I've seen from Democrats and Republicans.
I think the best outcome would be to continue the military operation, to continue degrading the nuclear and naval and ballistic and all the capabilities and creating the conditions for regime change. But assuming if there is negotiations, they reach some sort of agreement, that's an agreement that's sort of a narrow ceasefire. We're stopping the fighting, we're opening up the strait, but that doesn't include anything beyond, doesn't include sanctions relief, leaves all sort of the hardcore issues, perhaps for the next stage. Again, unless Iran is truly willing to agree to every single one of the United States' demands, but that seems to be highly unlikely.
I just think that no agreement with this regime is going to be sufficient because they're like a messianic, millenarian cult that wants to destroy Israel and believes that the U.S. is the great Satan. And they're just going to be highly motivated to do things that, you know, are a danger to the world. You know, it's, we see the immediate danger to Israel. We see the immediate danger to Gulf states. And, you know, we know that they have the capacity to threaten Europe and soon, I mean, they're already threatening Cyprus, but more of Europe and possibly the U.S., right? So as long as there's the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's any deal, the deals are barely worth the paper they're written on. You need a different Iran, a transformation to Iran, and how we bring that about. You know, there's different ideas and different statements. And we have a really great guest who talked at length about this. But I just like, I think any deal, like the range is from disastrous to not terrible. There's no good deal to be had with these people.
This, you're right. This week's guest, Sana Ebrahimi, who grew up in Tehran, left Tehran in 2019 and has become a prominent voice expressing opposition both while she was still in Tehran and now that she's in the United States, expressing the opposition and revealing the truth about the regime. And we have an incredibly powerful and inspiring conversation with her on this week's podcast. I would think there's actually been a few positive elements of the operation. One is the drawing closer of Israel and its Abraham Accords partners and even additional Gulf states. We've seen some of it's been reported, some of it's not been, but we've seen you know, higher degrees of defense cooperation, homeland security cooperation than we've ever seen before. We're also seeing, for example, renewed interest in the IMEC corridor, the India Middle East Europe corridor, which connects east to west. Because of the disruption in the Hormuz, we're seeing more and more interest both on the European side and the Western side and on the Indian side as well. And in general, I think because both Israel and the countries of the Gulf, in fact, in many ways, the countries of the Gulf more than Israel, are facing the same enemy in a very, very real and immediate way, it's also creating a deeper sense of we understand what we're going through and we have to stand together in order to stand up to this common enemy.
I mean, I don't want to be misunderstood. I think the operation has been very positive. I think the war has been a great success. I think it's an incomplete success, but I think it's been positive. It's the negotiating at this time and the chances of a deal that I'm much more skeptical about.
And it's a really important point. I mean, even I hope the war, in my sense, that there's still a lot more work to do, and therefore the operation shouldn't end. But even if they were to end,
And it would be really bad if there's linkage created between Iran and Lebanon, right? Because like the Israel's more intense operations in Lebanon started because Lebanon sort of joined this war attacking Israel together with Iran. But Israel, hopefully one of the things that Dermer will be talking to President Trump about is that the war in Lebanon can continue because it really needs to. I mean, Hezbollah needs to be pushed off of Israel's border.
Absolutely. And again, even if the war were to end this week, there's no doubt that there should be no mistake in that the achievements in terms of degrading the missile program, the nuclear program, and the Navy and the Air Force and the mechanisms of repression and decapitating the leadership, you know, it's almost beyond what anybody could have imagined. And the way the U.S. and Israel did this operation together in a more integrated manner that's probably ever been done in the history of modern warfare, that's an incredible accomplishment, whatever point the war ends. And that's an important context of perspective, I think, to keep in mind in any case.
Yes, definitely. Anyway, there's a war still happening, a much lower key war still happening in Gaza. The Trump administration is still working there to sort of wrap that up. I say the war is still going. I mean, many people, I think most people at Misegav would probably share that analysis with me for sure. The Trump administration is trying to make the ceasefire happen and complete it with its new sort of timeline for how Hamas should disarm. You have some of the details on that.
So this last week, Arye Lightstone, who is the assistant to Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, and actually my former boss at the Abraham Quartz Peace Institute and a friend, together with...
And the former head of was a national NCSY, which is always blows my mind as someone who went to NCSY's Jewish Orthodox youth group back in America. But anyway.
Arye is actually a remarkable person. Yes. Together with Nikolay Mladenov, the high representative for Gaza as the Board of Peace, they went to Cairo this week and met with Egyptian and I believe also Qatari mediators to present a roadmap from the perspective of the United States to Hamas for disarming. As we know that Hamas has refused to truly disarm. And in fact, they've recently been carrying out these sort of parades of white Toyotas like we saw on October 7th, driving through Khan Yunis and other parts of the Gaza Strip with masked armed gunmen, which is, by the way, what they did on October 7th, right? They fired rockets, but the attack was carried out by these Toyotas and masked gunmen. And they're back to that again. By the way, at the Misegav Institute, the head of the Institute, Meir Ben-Shabbat, made a recommendation that was a little bit controversial, which is that the IDF should act. Meaning, yes, it's true, we have to focus on Iran, and there's a flare-up in Lebanon. But we can't ignore this return of Hamas's power and its ability to threaten Israel, and therefore Israel should not necessarily start a high-intensity conflict, but should take military action against these massive displays of Hamas terrorist capabilities.
Well, whatever small percentage of our listeners read in Hebrew, they should read Meir Ben-Shabbat's newspaper columns because they're excellent. Some of them are translated into English in Yisrael Hayom, but I know he wrote a very long one for Makol Ishan. I think it was this past weekend, but it might have been the weekend before that, about how we shouldn't forget Gaza. And I think that's absolutely right. It's true that the south of Israel has mostly been spared the suffering, even though there was a very terrible missile strike in the south of Israel, but not on the Gaza border. The threat to them is not finished. The ceasefire is far from having its conditions met. The IDF is being spread thin right now, but it's just like if we don't take care of these things, they're going to come back to bite us later. It's the same with Hezbollah. And frankly, it's the same with Iran if this war ends prematurely. But I think on that note, we can start moving towards our guest. This is the Misegav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, a podcast for anyone who wants to understand what's happening in the Middle East. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a senior fellow at the Misegav Institute and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misegav Institute and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise and the headlines to bring you fresh insights into the most important issues on the Israeli and national and Middle East national security agenda, and to bring new voices, people who are on the ground, who can give a true perspective on what's really happening.
We encourage you to subscribe and to send this link, forward it to your friends, family, contacts, anyone you think who would be interested. And of course, to reach out to us with your comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We read all of your emails.
This week's guest is Sana Ebrahimi. Sana, born and raised to a very conservative Muslim family in Tehran, began speaking out against the regime when she was only 18 and still living in Tehran anonymously out of fear for retribution against her and her family. In 2019, she left Iran for the United States to pursue graduate studies, continued to speak out against the regime, and in 2022, during the Women Life Freedom Movement, she revealed her identity and has become a very prominent and important figure in giving voice to the regime opponents who are still in Iran, who are under the regime's reign of terror, whose internet is cut off. And in this conversation, we talk about her personal story, the situation on the ground, the Iranian opposition, the various figures and actors, and who is perhaps not quite what they seem, and the potential for regime change, what the path forward might be for the regime's opponents to rise up, like we saw in January, and retake their country and build a better future for the people of Iran. Sana is currently pursuing a PhD in computer science focused on responsible and reliable AI. And we talk about what she would recommend to Elon Musk about how to counter the Iranian regime's attacks on X against regime opponents like herself. So without further ado, stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Sana Ebrahimi. Sana Ebrahimi, welcome to Miskav Media Horizons. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure talking to you.
This must be very busy days for you.
Yeah, crazy things happening every moment.
It's interesting. And on your X feed, the first picture there is a picture of you as a 7-year-old girl wearing a chador, sort of this full body black coat and hijab style veil, sort of peeking out, I guess, maybe in a shy manner. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal story, your personal background, growing up in Tehran, coming to the U.S.?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Tehran. I was born into a pretty religious Muslim family, Shia Muslim. And I was a practicing Muslim until I was 18 years old. And then I started questioning it a lot. When I was a kid, well, you know how it is in Islam. They start like practicing things from a very early age, especially like for women. This gets more difficult, obviously. And my religious family, having hijab, wearing hijab was like a huge thing. And then I was also sent to Islamic school, like very conservative Islamic schools. And the dress code for those schools was chador, which is like the head to toe covering of like, it's a big long veil. And I started wearing that when I was 7 years old. And I kept wearing it until I was 18 years old. It was definitely like now that I think about it, after moving to States, I moved to States in 2019 after finishing my undergrad. I came here for graduate school as a graduate student. And thinking about it now, it's such a huge contrast when I think about my upbringing, where I came from, what I used to think, what I used to believe in, and what I know now. And what I believe in now, it's huge. And it didn't really start, I would say, it didn't start with me moving here. I started questioning things and learning things and changing a lot when I was still in Iran, growing up. And no one really had any answer to my questions. And usually when you ask questions, you just are met with a lot of pushbacks and hostility and no, you shouldn't be asking questions. You shouldn't be questioning this and that. And yeah, it was just a lot. And obviously, it's not easy growing up in like that religious environment to push back against things. You get ostracized, you get isolated a lot. But I kept going and I'm really glad that I did.
What was that like, you know, deciding to study abroad in an oppressive environment like where you grew up? I mean, like, was that something that other people did or was that like a big act of rebellion?
That was huge. I have cousins that were not even allowed to go to college because the college environment, like throughout school, like elementary, middle school, high school, boys and girls schools are separated, but then college is mixed. So you sit with other male students in the same class, and I have cousins that were not allowed to go to college because of that. And this is not really something that you say, oh, a lot of people on Twitter would like to say, oh, this is just your family, but that's not true. There are a lot of people, a lot of women, because you need permission, like you need your parents, your dad's permission, not even your parents per se. Really, women don't really have a say, but you need the permission from your father to do a lot of things. And because of that, a lot of women are really limited in what they can do and cannot. So moving abroad, obviously in an environment where like even going to college is kind of like a struggle and kind of a resistance, moving abroad was a no-no, not even traveling. I remember, I wasn't even allowed to travel alone by myself, let alone travel domestic, like inside Iran, let alone going abroad. And in my family, my extended family, like I was supposed to, if I wanted to follow the example of like my other cousins and other family and friends and associates even, I was supposed to get married at like 20 something, early 20s, and just have kids by now and live with my other family members. But yeah, I chose a different path. And when I decided to do that, I was again met with a lot of pushbacks and said, if you wanna leave, if you want us to allow you to leave, you have to get married. And obviously I said, no, again, you get a lot of pushbacks and there are a lot of tools to use, you know, because you're a woman, you don't have like that financial freedom to do things. I wasn't allowed to work either. So you have to like find ways to now get away. Okay, now I'm like financially, I'm very limited. Now, what are the other ways that I can use? And saying all of these, my family wasn't even the worst. Like, they were very religious and strict, but there are families in Iran that if they find out that their daughter has a boyfriend, they will murder them.
So then you come to the States and it's and you come as a student. Was it the Women Life Freedom Movement that began your activism, sort of your vocal opposition to the regime? Or did that even start beforehand?
Yeah, it started beforehand. When I was in Iran, I was pretty active. I was involved in like any kind of protest that I was able to. At school, there are some photos of me at school protesting right now back in Iran. I had a Twitter account back then. It was called Twitter. I had a Twitter account, was very active against the government on that account, on there, and an anonymous account. So it wasn't my name.
While you were still in Tehran. Wow.
Yes. And then once I started receiving a lot of attraction under that anonymous account and I started receiving threats, I was really worried that I will get arrested. So I closed that account. And then I started my new account after I left Iran. It was still anonymous. In 2019, when I opened it, it was still anonymous. It was like early, right after I left, it was the bloody November when for the first time ever, the government shut down the internet completely. For 3 days, there was nothing coming out of Iran. And in that 3 days, they killed 1,500 people in just 3 days. And I was, I like, my activism started getting back up.
This is November 2022?
2019. This is 2019. Okay. 2019. And then I was still anonymous. And then the Woman Life Freedom started in 2022, following the death of, like, the killing of Mahsa Amini. And that's when I started going public and changed my name. I revealed my identity. I changed my picture to something that you can clearly see who I am. And that's when I started my activism under my own identity.
Is there still a concern about your family that's still in Iran now that you've gone public with your name?
Oh, yeah, very much. When I started my activism, like 2023, it was when my family started receiving notifications and calls from around that they've been asking about me. The security forces, like the PSGs, they were asking about me, asking around. And obviously, I wasn't in Iran, so they couldn't really do much. And I am still to this day concerned that something might happen to my family, even though they have nothing to do with what I do here. But that's how the government works. They have recently announced that they're going to seize the properties of those who are active against the government, but they don't live in Iran. Thankfully, I don't own anything in Iran. I don't have anything in Iran, but yeah, I am concerned about my family's safety very much.
Can you walk us a little bit through the different Iranian opposition groups in the diaspora and inside Iran? The Republicans, the monarchists, the MEK and CRI, there's a new Iran Freedom Congress. Can you help us, for our audience who's maybe not familiar, sort of give us the lay of the land of the main opposition groups?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I'm going to start with reformists, because reformist movement started from within the Islamic Republic. And for long, people might not know. People may think, oh, people started rising up and immediately want a regime change. Like, what's up with that? But what they don't know is the build up to this moment. People did not start by chanting for a regime change. People started decades ago, started by calling for reform, because they still, well, everyone is very much aware of the costs that people have to pay in order to do a whole regime change. So people started by calling for reforms. The reformist movement came from within the regime. People who were moderates, or at least they pretended to be moderates, and were closer to the idea of, like, we need a modern country, we need to be able to work with other countries, or at least they pretended to be that way. But they were still under the umbrella of the supreme leader, Velayat Faqih. They still believed in the leadership of Khamenei and the foundations of the Islamic Revolution, but they were more like moderate. That started with Khatami, which was the previous president, Rafsanjani, one of the architects of the Islamic Revolution. So he came from within the regime. And then throughout the years, as it progressed, people started noticing that their lives and the way their uprisings and their opposition is being treated is not really that different under a reformist president or a fundamentalist president, which started in, like, during Khatami's, I think, presidency, the Kuye Danishgah happened, which, like, there was a protest erupted from universities, and then they raided dormitories and they threw students off buildings, one of the very prominent faces of that protest is Ahmad Bottabi, who gave a speech in the UN recently. So that was under a reformist government, again, oppression. And then it came with like Green Movement, that was again a reformist movement, but then it got to a like really critical point. Mir Hossein Mousavi, who was the leader of that movement, was basically told everyone that you should go back. You should just stop, because people started challenging basically the regime itself in 2009. And they didn't want that, even though they were a reformist movement. They didn't want to challenge the foundations of the Islamic regime. They just wanted to take control, basically. And then after that, when it got to a like tipping point, was during 2019, which was during Rouhani's presidency, who is a reformist. But again, the 1,500 people and the internet blackout, the 1,500 people killed and the internet blackout for the first time happened under his presidency. That's basically when the majority of the people who were protesting came to the conclusion that, okay, there's not going to be a reform. A reform doesn't really mean anything.
Meaning, as long as you stay in the framework of the regime of the Islamic Republic, then real reforms and preventing, you know, these violent crackdowns on protesters, that's not going to change.
Yeah. As long as no movement that is still under the umbrella of the Islamic regime can really succeed and give people what they want, which is freedom, the right, a prosperous country. So that's when the idea of regime change really was solidified among the elites, like the educated section of the protesters, and among the public. That was the reformist movement. That's like what they would like to call themselves, opposition, but they are not in fact oppositions. And there are a lot of their activists outside, abroad, in America and in Europe, and they are very active and they have really good influence in the media. They constantly write articles in Times and New York Times and Financial Times, Washington Post.
There's something in The Spectator this week that like my jaw dropped reading it. It was just all about how terrible the Emirates are and how, you know, they should be better friends to Iran. And I was just like, what is that?
Yeah. And those are reformists that would like to pretend basically that they are against the regime, but they are still operating under that umbrella. They just have like maybe some disagreements on some issues, especially when it comes to foreign policy. But they're the same thing. Their fundamental values are the same. The anti-America, anti-West, anti-Israel values are still at core the same thing, and they all believe in that. It's just that they have some surface-level disagreements. That's like the reformist. And then we have the MEK, which is a Marxist-Islamist group started before the revolution, and it actually started working with the Islamic revolutionaries, Islamist revolutionaries, which was led by Khomeini, the first supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. They started working, the MEK started working with Islamists to topple the Shah. They were in charge of armed operations. They were trained by Palestinian jihadist movements. They have photos with Yasser Arafat, their leader, Masoud Rajavi, their former leader, Masoud Rajavi, has photos with Yasser Arafat. Their logo is like a communist logo. So it's like they somehow found a way to mix Marxist ideologies with Islamism.
The original Red-Green Alliance.
Yes, yes, their original one, yeah. Their current leader, Mariam Rajavi, is wearing hijab. They have a dress code. They, like the former members who managed to escape this group, they talk about like the cult-like features that they have. And in foundation, like the fundamental values that they have, they're still the same as the Islamic Republic. Because if they were not the same, they would not be working together. What happened was that they worked together and they're hoping that they will gain some power within the country, within the government. But what happened was that when the Islamic Revolution succeeded, they got sidelined and Khomeini started eliminating them. We started like executing their members, killing them, imprisoning them. And then they started doing armed operation on the Islamic Republic figures. And eventually during Iran-Iraq war, they joined Saddam Hussein. And they fought alongside Saddam Hussein with Iranians. And they would like to say a lot that they were fighting the regime, but they killed thousands of Iranians on the way. So they are very, very hated. They are a very hated group among Iranians. I would say, if not more than the Islamic Republic, as much as the Islamic Republic, the majority of Iranians hate the MEK that is now rebranded itself as NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran. And they also have a really, they managed to gain this influence within the American political system and in Europe, even though they used to be a designated terrorist group until President Obama basically delisted them. And now they have like Mike Pompeo, they have Rudy Giuliani doing their biddings and basically promoting them within the like American political system. So, and then after the MEK, we have the Republicans and the monarchists. Now, here is very gets challenging. A lot of those reformists that we talked about like to portray themselves as Republicans. They would like to show their disagreement and their opposition to monarchists, or not even monarchists, like the pro-Prince Reza Pahlavi camp, as being a Republican. But in fact, what they are is reformist, and they have a really great relationship with reformists. They praise their like very prominent figures, which is the daughter of Rafsanjani, Faizeh Rafsanjani, Mir Hossein Mousavi, and like prominent reformist activist and figures inside Iran, just Hajzadeh. These are all very well-known reformists. Now, they would like to portray themselves as Republicans, but they are not. And this is where things get really complicated. And then we have I would like to call them pro-Prince Reza Pahlavi camp, because not all of them are monarchists. There are now, this camp has expanded. It started by monarchists who really believed in what Pahlavi dynasty stood for. And because of what it offered Iran and Iranians, a lot of freedoms, a prosperous country, a booming economy. For that, they really believed in the monarchy and the power and the value of monarchy for Iran. It started by that, but then it expanded itself because Prince Reza Pahlavi, who is the son of the late Shah of Iran, is a very secular, democratic figure. It really, if you listen to what it says and what he believes in, is a secular democratic government, not a system that is led by one person and one person in power. Because of that, the camp really got bigger and bigger as the time went on.
He said a number of times that he doesn't want to rule as a monarch. Yes. He wants to assist with the transition.
Yes, yes. And this is not just some talking points that he said once, just to, you know, just basically get people off his back. It was not like that. It's something that he believes in, and he has talked about it extensively throughout the 47 years of his work against the regime and for the people. Yeah, his advocacy for the people. He has said it multiple times, and he has discussed it in extent that this is why I believe in a secular democratic system that is not led only by one people. And I really believe in what people want. And you can really see the pattern when, like during the Green Movement, when people were asking for a reform, he was advocating for that. Because it's what people wanted. He said it multiple times, and I don't believe that the Islamic Republic is something that can really offer the people of Iran what they want. But because the majority of people were asking for that, he advocated for that. Throughout time, whenever people wanted something, even if it was against what he actually thought is the right move, he supported that because he believes in what the people of Iran want and how they want to choose their country to be governed. And again, in his plan that he has offered Iran Prosperity Project, and he has a really solid plan for that. You can read in detail the system that he would want to implement in Iran after the Islamic Republic is gone and during the transitional period, which includes a fair election where people choose what they want, whether it's a constitutional monarchy, whether it's a republic, whatever it is, people have to choose what they want for their country. So yeah, these are the things that we see. There are smaller movements that are really not that popular. Like they have separatists that believe in we have to for example, Kurdish areas of Iran have to have a separate country, and then Baluch people have to separate themselves. But these are not really popular movements, right, or line of thoughts inside Iran.
Right. I've heard from Iran experts, and also someone from an Iranian Kurd who I interviewed for an article that I wrote with them. They said that they feel very, that Iran is also a culture, and they feel very culturally Iranian. But I wanted to ask you, when you hear Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Donald Trump saying things that the people of Iran now are going to have the opportunity to sort of seize their future, what do you think of that in general? And also, do you see anyone on the ground who could do that, right? Because the son of the Shah, you know, even though it seems like he's the person with the greatest name recognition, he's not there, right? Like he can't make it happen. More than encouraging it. So how do you think this could actually happen? If you do.
What I think would happen, first of all, I think there is a large, despite what the media would like to show, Iranians are very pro-America, pro-Israel. When Prime Minister Netanyahu or President Trump send a statement, millions of people in Iran are watching. That's precisely why they have shut down the internet. Because they don't want people to listen to President Trump saying that, yeah, come out to the streets and protest and take your institutions. They don't want people to hear that. They don't want people to hear that Prime Minister Netanyahu says, we're going to support you, we're going to help you, we're going to back you. And they don't want people to hear that. So that's precisely why they keep people in the darkness. Now, how I think that would happen is that, I mean, again, this did not start in a vacuum of, let's say, January 8th and January 9th were the first time people raised against the government. This is not that. It has been happening throughout the years. And through experience, what we learned is that whenever people rise up, they're going to be met with bullets and arrests and torture and rape. Now, what we need to do, what people want, is a regime that its killing machine has been very, very weakened. A regime that cannot really stand against millions of people that are out in the street, the poor out in the street, because they have guns. Though they wouldn't have soldiers with machine guns mowing down protesters. They wouldn't have the command and control center that can basically organize those security forces and can bring in militias from Iraq and Afghanistan to kill its own people. That's what people have, and that's the vision we have in mind. When America and Israel attacked the regime bases, the Basiji bases, this is going to weaken the killing machine of the regime. And when the time is right, and when specifically President Trump sends in a statement and says that it is safe for their people to come out, because he has issued multiple statements, and every time he has said, U.S. Central Command also issued a statement asking people to stay inside because they don't want to raise civilian casualties. Unlike the regime in Iran that doesn't let people receive these warnings and want to raise civilian casualties, America and Israel don't want that. So they are asking people to stay in. Now, when they announce that it is safe for the people to come out, we are hoping that people will come out, because it's not like these are organic protests that erupt in Iran. People are unhappy, and their life has not only gotten better since January 8th and January 9th, but also it has gotten worse. Thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people are in the prison. Some of them are evading their execution without a trial, without access to lawyers. Some of them have already been executed. Tens of thousands of people were killed, shot and killed on January 8th and January 9th. They were hunted in the hospitals and they were finished off in hospital beds. So imagine if 10 people came out to the streets, and these 10 people have 4 or 5 family and friends, and they were killed. Now 4 or 5 family and friends are outraged and want the regime gone, even if they were unhappy but were not actively protesting against the regime. Now they are outraged. Imagine the outrage and anger and fury that people are suppressing, because they know that if they pour that out in the streets, they're going to get killed. And it's not going to go anywhere. But when people think that the killing machine is now weakened and destroyed, they will gain that courage and motivation back to come out to the street and take over the government. Now, with regards to Prince Reza Pahlavi, I think his idea, as he has said multiple times, that when the time is right, he will go back to Iran. Because the reason that he has lived in the exile is not that he wanted to. It's because if he stayed in Iran, him and his family would be executed. Just like many generals that served the Shah, and after the revolution, they were killed. They were all executed without a trial. Knowledgeable people who helped Iran's economy prosper during the Shah, they were all murdered. Abbas Hoveida is one of the very well-known figures that was executed, all because he served the Shah, not for any other reason. So that is why Prince Reza Pahlavi lives in exile, because he will be killed.
It sounds like at some point there'll be a pause or an end to the U.S. and Israeli aerial mm-hmm. campaign. And there'll be some sort of statement by President Trump, mm-hmm. by Prime Minister Netanyahu, that the aerial campaign is over, negotiations, agreement, whatever there might be. And then at that point, the Iranian people who are opposed to the regime will sort mm-hmm. of test the waters and see, okay, are they able to mm-hmm. go out? Are they able to protest? Are the besiegees shooting at them? Are they present? Are they out in force? Are they in smaller numbers? I guess another potential scenario could be a bit, correct me if I'm wrong, where sort of things in a sense go back to normal, but because there's no solution to the economic problems, so those continue to simmer and then they erupt maybe in a few months from now, maybe, you know, half a year from now. I don't know. What do you think is a realistic timeline, if you had to guess, or your best analysis in terms of when we might see a return to protest? And do you think we're seeing, some have claimed that there's kind of a rally around the flag phenomenon where even people oppose the regime, when they're seeing that the country is being attacked, they actually turn their support to the government out of sort of patriotic feelings.
And maybe we should just add some context, because we're talking and this podcast will come out in the middle of a period where President Trump paused some of the strikes on Iran to give negotiations a chance. And the negotiations are with the Islamic Republic regime. He made comments mm-hmm. to the effect of like, well, this is regime change because we killed so many of the leaders. But, you know, just like in Venezuela, we know that that's not really the case.
Mm-hmm. So I think the rally around the flag is also one talking point that the reformists that I told you about that are in D.C., very active in the media, like to talk about. They really were talking about that very enthusiastically before the war starts, because they were trying to prevent that to happen. And they were trying to basically create that image in my public's mind that this will happen, rally around the flag. But that's not true, because the people of Iran are very, very well aware of the fact that the reason that we are in the middle of this war is the Islamic Republic. The Islamic Republic has been campaigning for a war against Israel and America for decades. I remember that as a kid. I lived there. I went to school there. Remember that as a kid, we were going to my aunt's house in the highway. There was this big sign saying like 250 days until Israel is destroyed. And they would basically reset that every year because that never happened. But I would see that as a kid and I was like, What is our problem with Israel? What is it? Like, what is the issue here? And they would always say it was not because Israel had done anything to Iran. It was all because Palestinians need to take their lands and their state back. And growing up, you don't know, like, okay, now, what does that have to do with us? I mean, let's say whatever lies that you're saying is true. What does it have to do with us? Why would we get into a war to destroy Israel? Like, well, that's not of our interest. But that's that. And then death to America. I grew up at school every morning. They would stand us in a line and we would start our morning with death to America, death to Israel. Why? We don't know. But that's what it is. And then they changed the history books, the textbooks that we learned at school. They changed the history accordingly. That, oh, America is this like bad, great Satan. And then Israel is this little Satan. Now we have to destroy the little Satan so that we can destroy the great Satan. And they were very serious about that. They have shown that with the way they conducted themselves, with like all the terrorist militias and everything around the region. What do you think that's for? That has a reason. That's not for the protection of Iran. Iran could have been safe and sound like it was during the Shah. It could be a prosperous country like it was during the Shah. And we could have a great life. But we don't. Why is that? Because the terrorism adventures of the Islamic Republic. So the rally around the flag does not happen in Iran because people are very well aware of that. Aware of the fact that the problem here is the Islamic Republic. Why is our economy destroyed? Why wasn't it like this under the Shah? Israel existed back then. America existed back then. But it wasn't like that. We had great, great country because of the Islamic Republic. So people can really recognize the issue here is the Islamic Republic. And regarding the timeline, everything the scenario we talked about where Prince Reza Pahlavi would go back to Iran and lead the transitional period, obviously is our ideal, but there are a lot of other elements that have to fall into place for that to happen. I would say maybe a couple of months would be a realistic scenario. And after the aerial campaign is done, I would say maybe days, 2 months would be enough, would be a realistic scenario where people come back to the streets.
Do you think that people that will see that? Meaning, in just days or a month after the epic fury of Roaring Lion ends, we'll see people coming out to the streets again?
Yeah. I would say that's the case because people are outraged. The wound of January 8th and January 9th is very new. People haven't healed from that. Not only have they haven't healed from that, that's getting worse and worse by the regime that is now executing the people who were arrested, a bunch of kids, 18 years old, 17 years old, they're getting executed. For what? For protesting against the government. So I would say people are waiting for a chance to just come back to the streets and take the country back. Because what I think people don't really understand is the gravity of the situation in Iran under the Islamic Republic. We have water shortage in Iran. And what do you think will happen? And there is water shortage. People are just going to stay in and say, oh, something will happen. No, there's no water. What are you going to do? They've used all the water resources and reservoirs for building their tunnels, their subway system for their missiles. Under the cities of Iran that have water problems already. The middle of Iran is a desertish area. They have been struggling with water shortage for so long. The rivers, Zayan Derwood rivers, the biggest river in Isfahan, is dried. So we have that problem coming up next. So even if they stop the war today, there's going to be so many issues. The currency has collapsed. People cannot afford food. It's a daily struggle for them. These struggles haven't finished. Even the war, if the war stops today, these are not going anywhere. The collapsed economy is not going anywhere. The water shortage is not going anywhere. So people have to do something about it.
So I want to talk to you about a different topic because I know you're getting your PhD in computer science and that your expertise has to do with AI. In this war, we've seen, we recently talked to someone who's a tech expert about the way AI is changing the battlefield and targeting and things like that. But I want to talk to you about a different aspect of AI in the sort of communications and the sort of public view of the war and things like that. Because we've seen a lot of fake content being put up. I think that in this, Iran war round two, it's the worst that it's been. Israel's been dealing with this since October 7, 2023, but I think that now we're in a real deluge of just fake content. What do you think can be done to combat this? How can people sort of recognize what's fake and what's real? What do you think is going on here?
Oh, that's a very big issue in the AI world, specifically the language models, the generative AI, all the models that are used for creating those fake videos and fake photos. That's a real issue in tech right now. worldwide, not only limited to the political space, but across the board, this is a real issue about language models. Well, when it comes to generating language, they can, like generating text, they have found ways to manage that pretty well. But there is this big issue with regards to generating graphics and photos and videos. And then aside from that, the social media has not been designed in the way to deal with this fake content and being able to basically detect it very well. I mean, we see that happening to some level on X. They've added like the community node, flags for AI generated content, but still they're struggling with that. And that is something that I think it's going to go on for a while because they are still working on it. I mean, I personally, one of the things that I work on in my research is responsible AI. We have the issue of like this biased contents that is going across and then cascades through a social network and then gets worse. And then these things, now when it comes to the political environment, they have a substantial effect that you can see, like, people have a completely different view of what is happening inside Iran, which is rally around the flag. Going back to that, we see videos that are generated by the Islamic Republic media that are obviously, when we see it, we know obviously this is AI generated because we have people on the ground that are saying this is not happening. And then it will get amplified in the media. I think the least we can do while researchers like myself are working on finding ways to design something within the architecture of these models or like wraps that can layer these models and add some accountability and responsibility to the, this area. There should be some governance on the media that is amplifying this content. For example, like there is a lot still to do on X. X and Facebook and Instagram haven't done enough.
If you could give Elon Musk one piece of advice, what would you tell him?
It's really hard to give Elon Musk an advice. he's a very successful person.
No, but in terms of changing the rules for X so that.
Well, one thing that I personally am struggling with, aside from the fake content and AI generated content, is the coordinated campaign of report that is actually affecting a lot of the accounts, including myself. For example, I was limited. My account was locked for 12 hours yesterday because I offended a regime affiliate account. I said that I responded to a comment that was actually, they commented on my content and I responded with, I hope you who are obviously a regime affiliate person, part of their cyber army and your bosses, just the Islamic Republic, get hit by America. So this is in the context of the war. A lot of the things that are happening on X are detected by AI. They detect language and word. What I would suggest Elon Musk is to work on that issue instead of going like keyword and language search to detect like hate speech, violence, incitement, whatever. They have to add context to that. And they have to screen the users better. Like, for example, if an account has like a history of getting community noted a lot or is amplified by terrorists, which is the IRGC and regime affiliate accounts, you have to flag that account. And perhaps maybe if they start a coordinated campaign of reporting, you have to stop that. These are the things that they are not doing right now. They are relying on AI a lot, and these things haven't been incorporated in it. So yeah, I would say like maybe one thing that I am guessing, I have a strong guess that they are not doing, is who is amplifying this account? Maybe look into that account. If this account, like let's say Jackson Hinkle, is constantly being reposted by IRGC or like Houthis or Hezbollah or whatever, you'll have to detect that and you'll have to manage that in some way. You have to monitor that, the content that is coming out of that account. So yeah, I would say this is something they should do on X.
Sana, thank you so much. This has been amazing, inspiring. You have all these keyboard warriors online, but your courage in speaking out and taking on the Islamic regime is really admirable. So thank you so much for joining us in Middle East Horizons.
Thank you for being here.
And we hope to have you back after the fall of the regime. We hope to have you back to talk about the future of Iran.
Of course. I cannot wait. I have so many scenarios planned, like what I want to do after the regime falls and how I want to celebrate it, especially online. I would love to be back. Thank you so much for having me and giving me a platform to talk about what is happening inside Iran. I think this is invaluable. While there is a complete blackout in Iran, I think it's really important that we keep talking for those people that do not have a voice themselves. So thank you for giving me this platform to talk to your audience.
Thank you for listening to this week's Misgav Mideast Horizons. We will be back next week. In the meantime, make sure to subscribe. We're on all the major podcasting platforms. Give us good reviews. Pass the podcast on to anyone you think would be interested. And we will be back next week.
See you next time.